The theme for these two sessions has been announced, although not very far ahead of time, as an introduction to a capsuling of something of the thrust of the book, The Politics of Jesus, a book that is now 6 years old. And needs to begin by explaining why that title matters. So it's broken down into two different ways of approaching the same question. This morning, whether Jesus was a political person. And tomorrow, assuming that we got an answer to the first question, what kind of a political person Jesus was. And it isn't a waste of time to begin by asking why this should be a question. Because it is a question. In fact, it could be argued that most Christian traditions have held that in some sense Jesus is not to be seen directly in the context of what we call politics, that is, the realm of power and decision-making, and causing events to happen on a wide scale. Why is it that he is often held not to be relevant directly to politics? I see three kinds of reasons. There are questions of form. Religion, after all, is something else. Religion deals with the inner side of human existence, and politics with the outer, or faith and religion with the individual, and politics with the corporate, or the eternal, the temporal. There are various ways to do that same slicing into two dimensions of human existence, of which the non-political is in some sense held to be the most important from a religious perspective. So that in many segments of the Christian tradition, it's been assumed that the best way to be Christian is to achieve some distance from those other realms of day-by-day history, including, or par excellence, politics, so that you have time, space, sensitivity, or whatever it takes for religious perception. Some people do that geographically by going off into the mountains to be close to the stars and far from politics. Even within structured society, the clergy, in the medieval sense, the religious, are people who withdraw from agenda like that of politics in order to structure their entire life and thought around contemplation or ministry or study. So there's a whole gamut of Christian traditions according to which, by the very nature of the subject matter, faith and politics are distant. There's another set of reasons having to do with the content of faith in general, or specifically Jesus. What Jesus says and does and tells people to do don't fit the realm that we call politics. He says some things we don't want to do. He does some things we wouldn't like to imitate. And furthermore, we know pretty well that if we did what he says, it wouldn't work. The two specimens of this polarity that are the simplest, and therefore will serve the most cleanly as specimens for our purpose, are the question of money or material possessions, of which Jesus says that some people to follow him will have to give them all away, and that no one should lay up treasures for his future, and the realm of violence and the enemy, where Jesus says that the love which anybody knows applies to the neighbor, must include the enemy as a privileged neighbor. There would be other specimens, swearing of oath, the attitude of Jesus to religious duties and ritual, the attitude of Jesus even to marriage, but these two are probably the most striking samples that we will fittingly see working as test cases. Jesus tells us to do things with regard to money and the enemy, which if we did them wouldn't work. You couldn't run a society that way. And the third kind of questions that make us tend to assume that Jesus doesn't apply to our political experience, a little harder to find the right label, but they are questions of whether his world and our world connect. Questions of relevance, if the word weren't so cheap and used in so many different ways. Jesus, after all, lived in a time when people thought, and apparently even he thought, that the world was going to come to an end. Soon. Maybe in a couple months. Maybe in a couple years. Well, maybe even in a couple days. It almost would sound that way if you would read, without any other background, the message that he told the 12 or the 70 to preach when they went out. Then you really had the impression that the turning point of world history was right around the corner. Well, if the world that we know is going to end soon, then we can afford to live the way Jesus says. We can afford to give our money away because we won't be needing it anymore. We can afford to love our enemies because we don't have anything to defend against them. But of course, Jesus was wrong. The world didn't end. And the Apostle Paul just reproduced that difficulty a little farther down the line. In his earliest writings, he seemed to think it was coming very soon, and he writes to the Christians in Thessalonica about how it's going to be, and just reassures them that the people who did die won't be left out when it happens. By the later writings, Paul thinks maybe he even might die before the end of the world comes, but he still thinks it will be soon. Well, it wasn't soon after all. It's been almost 2,000 years. So, the ethics that fit the notion that the world wasn't going to last very long aren't ethics that fit our world, or the world of all the centuries in between. But Jesus' world is also a very small world. He preached most of his public parables of the kingdom and other kinds of discourses in small towns and even in the countryside, or standing in a fishing boat preaching to the shore. That is a small-scale society. And many of the things he calls his believers to do have to do with individual motivation, how my heart should change, how I should trust God, and with individual models of how to behave. What I do if someone strikes me on the cheek or asks me for a piece of my clothing. Individual actions, individual motivations make sense in the teachings of Jesus. But how much of the world can you handle with that kind of face-to-face model of human relationships and personalized model of the right thing to do? That is, it doesn't deal with people in offices, in institutional responsibilities. So for various reasons, of which these three headings are simply a selection, the most evident, the dominant religious traditions have in different ways set aside or compartmentalized the relevance of Jesus in such a way that the realm of the political is one to which he doesn't apply. The medieval tradition did it with sociological compartments. That is, there are some people who were called religious. And those people did commit themselves to live according to what was called then the body of evangelical counsels. That is, advice that you get from the gospel. Not rules, not obligations, but advice, counsel. The evangelical counsels were precisely poverty, chastity, nonviolence, obedience. Usually nonviolence wasn't listed as one of the three because it was presupposed. But all of those men, of course, that a religious person would not be a political person. They would live differently. They would live by begging, or they would live off of a foundation, or they would be supported by some other source that didn't call for them to be wealthy. They would take no responsibility for the police function or for international political identity and war and all the rest. The 16th century Reformation came along and didn't like that way of dividing it. There was a danger that these religious people would think they're better than other people. Of course, that also left the realm of the political to a kind of second level dignity. Didn't make it look like the thing that some people should do under God's command. There was by this time a feeling that despite this distance, the religious were in politics after all, through kinds of indirect means, through the confessional, in which they would tell lay people whether they were forgivable or not, or through the power of the bishop's office, which became politically and economically powerful, even though the bishop himself was not thought of as the owner of those dignities. So the fight against clericalism, that is the domination of society by the clergy, and the fight against people thinking that because they did try hard to be good people, that would make them acceptable before God, led to dividing this the other way. And the most thoroughly thought through way of putting this division in the 16th century was the doctrine of Martin Luther, of the two kingdoms, the two realms, the two ways of working. This is not a geographical split between two kingdoms. Kingdom is probably not the best phrasing, but each of the ways of trying to phrase this is difficult. There is the realm where the gospel operates. There is the realm where law operates. Both of these are God at work ruling, but in different ways and for different purposes. And it's very important to keep them apart. It is, in fact, the key function of careful Christian thought for Martin Luther to keep the two apart. This was not only because he was criticizing the way he felt Catholicism had put them together, but also the way he felt some other people in his time were mixing the two and thinking that gospel ethic could be imposed on the world. And his phrase was, you can't run the world, you can't rule the world with the gospel. Of course, we do have to rule the world, so we'll have to rule it with law. And once again, what Jesus is relevant for is not how you rule the world, but how you learn from God that he has accepted you. Now, I came to this tradition. What I've just played back up till now is the mainstream Western Christian tradition ever since the middle of the first millennium. Has different forms with different denominations, but agrees in most of what I said. I come to this with two kinds of reasons for doubting it. There's this way of setting Jesus aside as relevant to other things, like getting your sins forgiven, but not to the realm of politics. One is a formal question, just a question about the rules of thinking. If we decide that there is one major realm of human affairs in which what we know about God through Christ is not our norm, what does that do to the whole notion of revelation in Christ? And how far will that declaration of independence from Jesus go? Will there also be other realms? And how do you decide how far the autonomy of other values out from under the critique of Jesus will reach? How narrowly do we take the definition of the realm that Jesus does not guide us in because he's on the other level? That's a purely formal question, there might be an answer to it, but at least it's a source of being somewhat ill at ease with the mainstream tradition. The other reason has to do with the content of what Jesus tells us to do, that is, the samples that I mentioned before, where Jesus says, love your enemies. Western culture says, clobber your enemies when you have to. Jesus says, share the wealth. Western culture says, get all the wealth you can. And mainstream Christianity has been with Western culture and not with Jesus on that matters, those matters. In our time, there's some grounds for suspicion that those areas in which Christians took the liberty to run the world otherwise than the way Jesus said have not turned out to be completely successful. We haven't solved the world's economic problems by doing them our way rather than his way. And we haven't solved the problems of the enemy on the world scale by handling the enemy our way rather than his way. As the claim was, we could run the world if we didn't have the gospel holding us down. That is, holding us up. Setting standards we can't meet and that wouldn't apply. And so we've given ourselves in Western culture 1500 years of a blank check to run the world our way, and it isn't getting much better in some of the global dimensions of the meaning of material accumulation and the meaning of necessary violence against the enemy. And this doubt, although I stated in contemporary terms, happens also to be my denominational traditional inheritance and vocation. Since the late Middle Ages, beginning with the age of St. Francis and Peter Waldo, but going on through Western Protestant history, there have been in every century new breakthroughs of church renewal concern that led people, always minority groups, but repeatedly, to challenge especially the mainstream position of Christians on violence and war and the enemy. In the 16th century, these people were called Anabaptists. In the 15th century, they were called the Unity of Brethren in Moravia. In the 17th century, they were called Quakers in Puritan England. In 18th century Pietism, they were called Brethren. In 19th century, they were called abolitionists and disciples in this country. It has recurrently happened that in the process of church renewal, people have said that the question of the ethics of Jesus with regard to the enemy and wealth also needs to be reopened. And I happen to be responsible to share in the communication tasks of one of those traditions, the so-called Anabaptist movement of the 16th century, left behind it a tradition which is now called by the name of one of its second generation leaders, Mennonite, as if Lutherans were called Melanchthonians, by the name of a second generation organizer and teacher. But you don't decide whom to be named for by your critics. So the Mennonite community is one of three so-called historic peace churches whose place within the ecumenical mix is to communicate concern about specifically the place of violence and the dignity of the enemy as something that Christians haven't finished talking about on an ecumenical scale. That's my specific way into the doubt about whether the easy way of writing off the political relevance of Jesus is acceptable. Now that's all introduction, but I think it's the bulk of what needed to be done first so as to see what needs to be done next. I just went back to the New Testament texts as they stand with this question. Is it the case, if we just read the texts, as it has come to be assumed to be the case in Western Christian tradition, that Jesus is not a political personage? I say just as the texts stand, because of course we do have to take account of the fact that the texts are subject to literary, historical, critical analysis. there is some distance in time and transmission between the life of Jesus himself and the Gospels as we have them. I could deal with that distance as well, but it would just be an additional complication, so for present purposes I propose just to stay with the text as we have it. And leaf now through the Gospels, especially because of the way it's organized, beginning with the Gospel according to Luke, not reading anything at depth, but just observing all along the way the signals that speak to the question, as we've now put it. Was this man Jesus politically relevant, or was he so individualistic, or so much a representative of village culture, or so preoccupied with the coming end of the world that he couldn't handle those questions, or didn't care to, or even perhaps wanted not to? The first chapter of Luke's Gospel makes it clear to somebody who was close to the text — it doesn't always make it clear to the modern reader — that Jesus came into a cultural setting where the political agenda mattered to everybody. As there are possibly cultural settings where people don't ask questions about power. Everybody has enough, or the world is not big enough to tempt people. There may be contexts where this is not the case, but at least here the awareness of what's going on in the world includes at least the element of political oppression as part of what's wrong with the situation we are in, putting ourselves in the position of the Jews of the time. The text that we know the best from Luke chapter 1 is the one that has very wide use in our liturgies, in the Song of Mary. We have used it so much through liturgies and with reference to spiritual applications to our problems that we have real difficulty getting back through the screen of our use of it to ask how it must have sounded at the time. To use phrases like this: Mary's soul magnifies the Lord. And what is he doing, or what is he going to do? There's a particular Hebraic poetic trick that speaks of the future in the past tense. When you know for sure that God is going to do something, you sing about it in the past tense, even though it hasn't happened yet. So Mary is saying in the past tense what God is going to do. And obviously people who read this text afterwards, or the people who use it since in the liturgy, use it properly in the past tense because it has happened, whatever that is. But what is the whatever that is that God was going to do? Future for Mary and past for us. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He has put down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of low degree. He has filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he has sent empty away. Now that's all political language and economic language. That is not spiritual language. That's not the language of piety or cult or liturgy. That's the language of radical social change. The powerful get put down, the humble get raised, the rich don't have what they had anymore, and the poor get it. Now that's the language of radical social critique. When God's going to act, that's what he's going to do. We have yet at the end of the chapter another song at the birth of Jesus' cousin John. His father sings something similar. God has remembered his promise that we should be saved from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us, to grant us that we, being delivered from the hand of our enemies, might serve God without fear. Now that's to be taken seriously and literally in that time, because the Jews lived in a period of very serious political oppression. They were colonized by the Romans after the failure in the preceding centuries of the last effort to have their own kingdom, the Maccabean period. This did not mean simply that they had no independence in international relations, they weren't a sovereign nation. It also meant that they were heavily taxed. And the taxation comes in the beginning of the Christmas story. That's why we have dates for the Christmas story, because there, and it's why Jesus was born in Bethlehem rather than somewhere else, because of a tax registration program for the whole empire. We don't know all the details, obviously, but such indices as the archaeologists and the historians can get indicate that this taxation really made life miserable and not simply somewhat uncomfortable, and they had no access to solutions of the Proposition 13 type. When they thought the tax was too heavy, they just had to suffer. But they could hope, and their hope was a political, economic liberation, which is what God was going to give us, because he promised to remember the promise he made to our fathers and give us that freedom. But it wasn't only a political and economic oppression, it was also an ideological or religious oppression, because these oppressors were polytheists, and they were idolaters, and they were pork eaters. As they were people who themselves offended against the law of God at the most fundamental points, and who succeeded. So it wasn't just a matter of our being uncomfortable under oppression. It was a matter of the honor of God being challenged when people who did not honor him and in fact disobeyed the first commandments against idolatry and polytheism would succeed in the world. So the concern is not simply a selfish concern for being a little less bad off. It's a theological concern for the honor of God as the sovereign of history, when it is hoped that God is going to act to free his people. So Jesus came into a situation where the expectations were clearly of political, social upheaval in the direction of justice. You could read some of the same things if you read carefully the Christmas stories, but let's leap to chapter 3 of Luke's Gospel. And here we have the actual narrative beginning of the public movement with John, his predecessor. John preaches in the desert that the way for the Lord must be made straight. He uses bulldozer language, pulling down the mountains and raising the valleys so as to make a processional highway, a straight road. This is the prophetic basis for the interstate system. And there are two kinds of, there's a multitude there. But only two questions come to him. That is, two specific categories of people are challenged, threatened, and come to him to ask what they should do. And who are those two categories of people? They are the tax collectors and the soldiers. That is, the two categories of people who represented what was going to collapse, what was going to be judged. Before that, he gave more general answers and wasn't said who was asking or the multitudes were asking. And his answer to them was, there's a new economic order coming. The multitudes asked, this is Luke 3:10, what then shall we do? As if we're supposed to repent. He who has two coats, let him share with him who has none. He who has food, let him do likewise. And then the tax collectors asked, the people who were the agents of the Roman presence. And he said, only collect what you have coming, since they both mostly lived on the fact that they collected more than they had coming. This would be a radical sacrifice. And the soldiers were told not to extort, that is, not to use their violent presence as a means of personal advantage. Be content with your wages. I was reading this passage in Argentina several years ago when it first became clear how much difference that would make in an economy, if in most of the world the military regimes were content with their wages. And then Jesus arises in that context, he is given by John's baptism the mantle of the one who was called, or the one who came to be the object of God's election, and the one in whom he has pleasure. Where'd that language come from? Well, that's again political language. I have chosen you, you are the one in whom I have good pleasure, is found in Isaiah 52 in the Messianic Psalms, and it's found in some of the Psalms which are enthronement Psalms, that is, Psalms which were sung at the celebration of, or the commemoration of, the coronation of a king in ancient Israel. So Jesus is welcomed by the voice from heaven as the one designated to be king. Now, how do you go about being a king? Well, we have three temptations. Now, how do you go about being a king? Well, we have three temptations. And the three temptations are much more than we usually see three ways to be king. We have pietized or individualized those temptations so much that we don't take them straight the way a reader at that time would have. Jesus is in the desert having fasted, and the tempter says, "Why don't you make bread?" Now, if it were a matter of his own personal need for nourishment, he wouldn't have needed to make much bread, because people who fasted don't start eating much. But they were talking about a whole field of boulders that he was supposed to make into bread. It was obviously the vision that he would, by using exceptional powers which are available to a Messiah in first century cosmology, he would satisfy people, he would feed people, and that's a way to be a king. And that's not such a bad idea, because the Romans were doing that. They were maintaining their political sovereignty by feeding the crowds in Rome that had the right to vote. And a few chapters later, we do find that Jesus does feed a large number of people in a desert, and they want to make him king. The devil was right. We misunderstand the temptations if we think that Jesus was tempted by having things proposed to him that would have been silly or make no sense or not be very important. No, he was being shown a way to be king. You can have a welfare state. So it wasn't just a matter of personal ethics and whether he was going to kind of take advantage of his miracle-making power to meet his own short-range needs. No, it was how he was going to be king. And similarly, the matter of throwing himself into the temple courtyard is not just kind of acrobatic proof. Hey, look, I can jump down and not splatter. But it would have been a fulfillment of the expectation of the very last verses of the Old Testament. The Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple and purify the sons of Levi. That is, he would appear in the temple from above. No, people don't spend their time watching the temple roof, so when he came, they thought he came from heaven, simply. And he'd take over and clean up the place, and that's a very good way to start if you're going to be Messiah. And Jesus did that too. And the story at the end of his ministry that we call the purification of the temple, Jesus did something very much like that. He came into the temple and surprised people and cleaned it out. So again, the devil was proposing that he might do something he did finally do in another context. So the self-definition of Jesus in his calling is a matter of responding to alternate ways of being the king. Never in this process, and now I have to generalize a little, never through his entire ministry does Jesus say, no, you got me all wrong, I'm trying to teach you the sacraments, or I want to get through this life so I can leave behind a viable religious institution. He doesn't define his reason for not doing exactly what the people want as that they shouldn't want a king. No, he is the king they're looking for. They just didn't know quite what he should look like. So some people who have a definition of how he should be political will be disappointed and will reject him. But not because he isn't political, because he's on the wrong side, rather. Because he's political, but in a different way. And that's a fundamental shift in our interpretation of why it was that Jesus was not acceptable to the people who didn't accept him. It wasn't that he wasn't political, but he told them, you're waiting for a king and I'm not going to be a king. He said, the kind of king you're waiting for is not the kind of king God wants you to have. But he does promise that now his kingdom is breaking into your experience. And the language for that is not ritual or theological in the sense of talking about the nature of divine being, but it is how to live together, how to make decisions, what to do about power, what to do about status, all of the agenda of what we call political. The last specific text that I want to look to at the beginning of Jesus' ministry is his first appearance in his hometown synagogue, where he reads from Isaiah chapter 61, a messianic passage, that is, the person speaking through the prophet says, I'm the Messiah, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me. And what is this anointed one going to do? To preach good news to the poor, to proclaim release to captives, to recover the recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty the oppressed, and to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. So of these five things that the Messiah is going to do, one of them is the kind of messianic sign of power that Jesus did for individuals, giving sight to the blind. Three of them have to do explicitly with bringing people out of bondage or poverty. And the fifth we'll have to look at some more, proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. In English that doesn't mean anything. In the original Hebrew it was an already clearly defined technical term for the Jubilee year. The year of Yahweh in the Old Testament was the year of Jubilee. That doesn't come from the Latin root jubilate, which means be happy, although it would be a reason to be happy. It has a different root in Hebrew. But it was, again, a very concretely social phenomenon. We have in Leviticus and Deuteronomy the provisions for a periodic redistribution of wealth. If you are especially industrious, or you have healthy children who can help you on the farm, or you're a good organizer and your luck is good, you'll get wealthy. If you have bad luck, or your children all happen to be girls, or you get sick, or you're a bad manager, you'll get poor. This Hebrew legislation doesn't interfere with the market mechanisms of work and productivity that let some people get wealthy and some people get poor, but it does provide that every 50 years that'll be evened out. Every 7 years already there was a year of Sabbath in which the land rested and certain slaves were freed, but every 7 times 7, or 49, the 50th year, the Jubilee year, all land goes back to the family to which it belonged 50 years ago. And the people who had accumulated extra, they'd had their use of it all that time. And people who had become poor, they'd suffered enough. Now you start over. Now, we don't know whether that was ever done by the Jews. It's kind of like the ethics of Moses, it's kind of like the ethics of Jesus. We're not sure the world would work if we did it that way. But the message is clear. This land belongs to the Lord. The Lord gave it to us, and he divided it among the tribes, and in each tribe it was divided among the families and the clans and the subfamilies, and that's to stay that way. You're the stewards. Now, if you do a good job, you produce more, you get more. More is entrusted to you, but every 50 years we start over. And the grandchildren of the person who lost it get another chance to start making good use of their share of the land that God lets us use. That's the vision. We don't know whether the Hebrews had ever practiced it, but it was in the prophetic expectation that when the Messiah comes, that's what he's going to do. That's what we have in Isaiah 61. And now Jesus says, and Luke builds it up by saying everybody's eyes are upon him. That is apparently a very dramatic kind of pause. And why in the world would he read this text now? Well, maybe it was in the lectionary for that week. But what's he going to do with this text? A text about the Messiah. And he says, today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. And he says, now this messianic expectation is coming off. We could go through the rest of the gospel page by page. All I should try to say now is that this first impression is rounded out and confirmed much more than it is ever undercut by continuing to read with these questions in mind. There are places where Jesus refers specifically to Herod's administration and uses what we'd call political jokes. He makes fun of two failures of Herod's administration in chapter 13. He creates a new body of disciples. It's a dramatic thing to do if you want to change a society. Create a small group of people who are deeply committed to what you're doing and provide them for structures for living apart from the wider society. Cell structure rather than just waiting for the whole society to change. His ethical teaching, which we'll look at more tomorrow, points also in the direction of changing social structures. But I'd like to end the introduction and hope to have 2 minutes for conversation with or discussion, questioning, just to leap to the end. The people that were doing the nearest thing to what Jesus was sounding like were the people historians now call zealots. That particular word we find in some of the later historians of the first century. It's not sure that that was used right at the time of Jesus, and it just described one group, whereas there were many groups like this, but we now use it as a type term and not just the name that a certain group used. People of zeal, zealots. Ever since the failure of the Maccabean kingdom, centuries before, had been trying every once in a while for some kind of a righteous revolution. We have them recorded at various places, alluded to in various places in the New Testament story. One of Jesus' disciples is specifically named Simon the Zealot. If we read carefully the snatches of information we have about other disciples, it may be that as many as half of the 12 came from zealot background. Every decade or two there was an uprising, and the Romans always put it down easily and bloodied it. The first time the Romans didn't put this uprising down easily was when in the year 66 the zealot movement did succeed. Incidentally, its leader was named Menachem, same as today's zealot leader of Israel. They took over Jerusalem for 2 years, and it took 2 more years for the Romans to smash the uprising and destroy the city. And then once again in around 130, there was 1 more such revolution, and again the Romans smashed the city. So this model of righteous revolutionary uprising, which in our recent experience is called National Liberation Front, was the explicit concern and expectation of a major slice of Jesus' audience, including some of the people closest to him. That was his real temptation. Obviously, we can't document that as much as if we look closer, but the way it was a temptation for Jesus to be political was not the way of working his way into the establishment, studying political science and starting up the ladder of bureaucratic concern, or making it in business and then being invited to be an ambassador. No, he was tempted to righteous revolution. And where do we see that the most dramatically? The last time? Obviously the cleansing of the temple comes close, but Gethsemane is even more striking. We read the Gethsemane story with such piety and reverence that we often don't stop to think what that alternative was that Jesus was asking for. He first asked, "Let this cup pass from me." That is, "I don't want to go the way of the cross if I don't have to." What would that other way have been? Well, we are so reverent about how it did have to be that we don't stop and make it really human what else it might have been. But if we ask that question, really the only serious answer is it would have been a successful holy war. That is, he would have taken the zealot option. And instead of simply letting himself be crucified, he would at least have gone down fighting, and maybe even have succeeded. In fact, he should have succeeded because God was on his side. And when he reprimands Peter for trying to defend him, he says, "Don't you know that I could have had 12 legions of angels?" A Roman legion was 6,000 soldiers. So 12 legions of angels is 72,000 angels. And that many angels in that garden would have made quite a hullabaloo, and probably there was some chance of winning the war. I don't know what they would have looked like, but, you know, it's supposed to be a way to make fun of the Middle Ages to say that they discussed how many angels could stand on the head of a pin, but if you're going to have 72,000 in a garden, you better think about those things. The zealots believed that when the holy war came, God would send his angels and it would be won. The holy war would be God's victory, just like in the days of Joshua. And Jesus, according to Matthew, thought of that as a real option and set it aside. But he thought of it. And he was put to death because he could be accused of being a pretendant to the throne. They tell us even today that the reason for the death penalty is it teaches people a lesson. Well, if the death penalty is to teach people not to commit crimes, you have to tell them what crime the criminal is being put to death for. So the Roman legislation provided that every time someone was put to death, there should be a sign saying what he's being put to death for. So the text on the cross was not just a whim of Pilate, it was a Roman requirement. It said, "This is man is being put to death because he's the king of the Jews." He's a zealot, in other words. He's an insurrectionist. That is the formal title for his execution, even though, according to the story as we now have it, Pilate didn't really believe that was the case. He still acted on the basis of that accusation. So Jesus was so much like a zealot that being a zealot was his temptation, righteous revolution. And that he looked enough like a zealot that he could be turned over to the Romans with the accusation that he was one, and be put to death for that. Now, why Jesus was so much like the zealots in his language, in the expectations he came to fulfill, and then why he was different from the zealots at a dramatic place, that would be the theme for tomorrow. But for today, we would still have 2 or 3 minutes. If any of these points, you should have interrupted me before and didn't take the initiative. Now I'll forgive you and I'll give you another chance.
did the zealots look like? Were they a special breed?
They were just especially committed Jews who believed that God didn't want his people to be slaves.
Why did you say that Jesus looked like one?
He appeared in not in his physical appearance, but no, I didn't mean physical appearance. No, I mean just you would take him for one because of what he said.
Was John the Baptist a zealot?
Generally, that he isn't put quite in that category, but again, there are connections because of his his condemnation of the pleasant political system. The text we have here, the strong language of his first preaching that. Everything's going to be chopped down, the axe is at the foot of the tree. His disappointment with Jesus, that's indicated in the sending messengers to Jesus to ask, are you the one I was waiting for? Because here I'm waiting in jail. And even the thing for which he got himself finally in trouble, scolding Herod for a marriage. We generally think the reason he scolded Herod for marrying his sister-in-law was that you shouldn't marry your sister-in-law. But it was more important than that. This was a political marriage. She was the daughter of a neighboring king. So it was political just as much as, or perhaps even more, than it was a marriage of personal desire. So that John's posture is a politically critical posture. He wasn't organizing a zealot war because he thought he had a successor who was going to do that. But he was kind of waiting for the same movement. This is the way it's generally read. That would be a different subject that maybe we should get at sometime later. What is this? What are the shifts that matter the most between then and now to set up this screen of other interpretations? And I think any answer now would have to be too quick to be responsible. Some of them certainly would be in the realm that we would call linguistic or philosophical. That is, where did we develop the inner, outer, or the upper, lower, or the individual social ways of sifting things so that we look for the non-political message in a story of a leader of people. Another would be that, especially after Constantine, Christians got themselves in the responsibility of having to run the world. And you can't do that very well with Jesus kind of politics. And so you have to look for somebody else's. Those are my two global answers, but of course each of them is too brief, and we might want to make that a topic for later. I should have said at the beginning, I kind of assumed it because of university seminar style, and that was a mistake, that I would be happy to be interrupted along the way or pushed at further points.
Would you comment on Jesus and the context and the meaning of Jesus' statement, my kingdom is not of this world, and of
enlightenment? We'll look at that tomorrow as a major chunk. Yeah, it belongs.
He leaves today.
Oh, you're leaving today. Well, I think the brief answer would be to say that this world does not refer to politics versus something else, but to one political style versus another. If my way of being king were your way of being king, Pilate, then we'd fight back. But the next sentence says, if it were, then the way my servants would save me would be to save me with swords, like Peter was trying to do. But it's a different kind. But it's not a different kind, and it's not a kingdom. It's not, that's in John, and John has a special meaning for the word world. It's not of this fallen system. It's not of, it doesn't mean this world in the modern sense as though we're against the otherworldly, but it means my kingdom is not a part of the demonic system that you represent, Pilate. It's still in the world of human affairs, but it's not in the fallen system that you represent in threatening my life. So it's not on the same level with your system, Pilate, but he's not saying that it's only spiritual or only individual. It's a different way of being political. So you had to.
Well, I just wanted you to comment a little bit more on the kingdom, the two kingdom theory, but we'll short of time.
Yeah, well, let's do that the next time or in some other part of the process. I guess we'll always have to have people, when they have questions, indicate how many days they're going to be here yet.
I'll be here tonight.